David Zirin has been called the best young sports writer in America. He's the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States, 250 years of politics, protest, people, and play. Zirin told Steve Paulson what's unique about his approach to sports history.
Well, because more conventional histories of sports, I would argue, are bosses' histories of sports. I mean, they're sports told from the top down, where every player is the love child of John Wayne and Sarah Palin, one man against obstacles as they try to somehow achieve the ultimate goal of a championship in a Wheaties box. That's the typical sports history that we get so much of. A People's History of Sports tries instead to look at sports from the bottom up. It tries to look at the true origins of different sports and at the way sports have reflected politics throughout the time in this country. Because that's really the goal of the book, is to just put a stake in the heart of this idea that sports and politics have nothing to do with each other. I wanted to return the history of sports into the broader world.
So you're not that interested in great athletic triumphs, though?
Well, I am, but I'm more interested in how those triumphs were then reflected in the real world and not existing in some sort of hermetically sealed vacuum. Like, I am interested, for example, in Joe Louis's fight against the Hitler favorite Max Schmeling in 1938. I am interested in Jesse Owens at the Olympics in 36 and Jackie Robinson and Billie Jean King and Muhammad Ali and Arthur Ashe. I'm interested in all those stories. So those stories of individuals. Like, I don't sacrifice the individual achievement, but I want to know how those stories were then received, because one of the things I believe about sports is that it has a tremendously important and often overlooked symbolic power when it comes to politics. I mean, we all know about activist athletes like, say, a Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their black glove fist at the 68 Olympics, or Muhammad Ali resisting the draft, or Billie Jean King marching for Title IX legislation for women's rights. These are explicit political acts.
Is race still the biggest tension that underlies sports, especially the major American sports?
I think it's the most discussed tension, but I think if you ask specifically about underlying tensions, I think at this point it's about sexuality and human sexuality. I mean, it's still very striking to me that in all the male sports, you've still yet to have an athlete come out as an active player. I mean, you've had several at this point come out when they've retired, people like John Amici, the NBA player, or Asera Tuolo, NFL player. But when it comes to the practice of being able to be open about your sexuality, that is one of the great underlying tensions in male sports and in female sports as well, because oftentimes women's sports are sort of portrayed as being an almost sexual Shangri-La in terms of there being such an openness for lesbian athletes. But if you look at the actual numbers, like in the WNBA, for example, you can count the number of women who've been able to come out on one hand.
Do you think that's also true in locker rooms? I mean, do you think it's, if you're a gay athlete, do you pretty much just have to keep that totally under wraps? Otherwise, you're going to get into a lot of trouble.
Well, it's interesting because you ask about have to. According to polls, there would be a tremendous acceptance if there was a gay athlete in the locker room. But then again, it's almost like a sexual Bradley effect, if you will. You know, like, are they just saying that because they're being asked and don't want to look homophobic or not? My understanding is that the level of homophobia in a locker room is very intense. And I do think that there are real fears about how it would be accepted. And people, particularly pro athletes who are gay, have learned to keep that in the closet their whole lives. And so the idea of changing, I really do think it would take a broader movement in the streets to really inspire an athlete to come out at this point. But when it does, I think you would see a situation not unlike when Jackie Robinson broke the color line in 1947, where every play he did, every time a teammate looked out for him, I mean, it was more than just the moment. It had this almost titanic symbolic value.
That's interesting. So you think this would be way more than just, here's the first out gay athlete on a professional team. You're thinking it would have a ripple effect throughout society. Oh,
you would have a gay politics beat on SportsCenter if it happened, where they would be following and analyzing every possible moment of their playing day as if they were semiotics professors at the University of Wisconsin. I mean, they would just be looking at this and going through it with a fine-tooth comb. And I think it would also start a conversation on sports radio that in many ways would be more honest than the kind of discussions one often gets on more political talk shows.
Let's talk about one of the most widely admired athletes, Michael Jordan, probably the greatest basketball player of all time, also one of the great pitchmen. Jordan's famous for never saying anything political because he doesn't want to jeopardize his sponsorship deals. Do you have a problem with him?
Yeah, the famous Jordan line is when he was asked to endorse Harvey Gantt when he was running for Senate against Jesse Helms, who's an African-American mayor from Charlotte, and Jordan declined by saying Republicans buy shoes too. And it's become something that is, I guarantee you, is going to be in his obituary when it's all said and done, because it's gained resonance over time, because many of the athletes today are considered the sons and daughters of Michael Jordan, in that the goal is not to become, and this is where I think a critique of Jordan is very worthy, is the goal is not to be a human being who happens to play sports. The goal is to be a brand. And that really started with Jordan, the Jordan brand. And the Jordan brand, what that meant was, it doesn't matter who Michael Jordan is. It doesn't matter if he's mean to the press. It doesn't matter if he's a jerk in his private time. Nothing matters except for the fact that he's able to present an image of an empty vessel who the viewer or the consumer can pour into him and project whatever they want.
Of course, he had to be a phenomenally good basketball player to be able to pull this off.
Exactly. And that's one of the contradictions about, and one of, I think one of the tragedies about a lot of players today, striving to become a brand. It really only works if you can inspire athletically. And I just think there's something harmful and detrimental about that, particularly because, I mean, athletes are role models to such a great degree that for young people to see that the goal is to actually beat the ideas out of yourself for the purpose, the almighty purpose of selling products. I mean, that to me is very problematic. But I'll tell you, it's like you got to separate the art and the artist. I mean, I truly do believe, we talk about the value of symbolism, that Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player to ever live. I mean, he's an absolute artist. But at the same time, he also had an unprecedented cultural platform to actually do something.
But maybe he didn't want to do that. Maybe right. He really just genuinely was not a political person and wanted to make a lot of money by selling shoes. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, there's no maybe about it. I mean, that's absolutely what his goal. And he would speak about that openly, about like, well, I was born in, I think it was 63, and that's just not who I was. You know, that just wasn't my experience. But the problem was that he was directly involved in certain issues that could have done something. I mean, one of the most basic ones is he was approached again and again by people who were challenging Nike's labor practices. And he had paid some lip service to them about, well, I'm going to go there and check for myself the factories in Southeast Asia. I'm going to see for myself if kids are being exploited to make these shoes with my name on it. And he would say that, but then never do it. And so when you think about somebody who, I mean, this isn't just somebody who, I mean, you described him as a pitch man. He was more than a pitch man. I mean, he runs his own division now of Nike called Jumpman 23. And even as a player, he was so much more than a pitch man. I mean, he was somebody who wielded responsibility for Nike's ascension. And people like Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike, they understood that. And so you're talking about now issues of not just athlete as pitch man, does he have to be political? Now we're getting in issues of corporate responsibility.
Do you see Tiger Woods in the same light as Michael
way,
Jordan?
I feel actually much harsher about Tiger Woods than I do about Michael Jordan. Because with Michael Jordan, I do tend to look at it much more of an issue as an issue of corporate responsibility. And well, you know, if you're going to be running a division of Nike, people have the right to challenge you on your labor practices, and you have an obligation to say what those are all about. But with Woods, Tiger Woods, I feel even more like a greater sense, I guess, of aggrievement, because Tiger Woods and Nike have chosen to use a lot of the symbolism of the civil rights movement to sell Tiger Woods to the American people.
How so?
Like there's a famous commercial, I am Tiger Woods, I am Tiger Woods, I am Tiger Woods. And that, of course, is a reference to the Spike Lee film Malcolm X, where all the little kids say, I am Malcolm X, I am Malcolm X. And that is a tribute to, after the death of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther Party leader, young kids in Chicago on a film saying, I am Fred Hampton, I am Fred Hampton. And obviously that is a reference to Spartacus, I am Spartacus, I am Spartacus. And then there's the other ads where he says, you know, there was a time where someone like me couldn't X, couldn't Y, couldn't Z. And that's it's all for the almighty purpose of selling us things with swooshes on them.
And yet, on the other hand, Tiger Woods has said some pretty interesting things about his racial history. I mean, he's been, you know, very upfront about being biracial and not wanting to be pegged in any racial category.
Sure. But I don't think that that's in any way a political act. That's just trying to make a statement of reality and actually trying to step outside the assigned role of blackness that a lot of the media has attempted to put on him, the first black this, the first black that. And, you know, and I give him all the credit, and he's got every right in the world to say, well, wait a minute, my mom's from Thailand, I'm part white, I'm Kablin Asian, as he puts it. And if he wants to claim that full history, That's all well and good. My problem, though, is when you use the history of the struggle itself for racial equality, and specifically that history for racial equality in sports. I mean, let's keep in mind, golf wasn't even fully integrated until 1975, for goodness sakes. I mean, we're talking about Jackie Robinson, 1947, go 1975. I mean, I think that there's an obligation then to then say, you can't just use this history to sell us products. Mm-hmm. It's like you have to actually stand for something then. Because I am sympathetic to when people say, well, why are you asking Tiger Woods about this? Why don't you ask Phil Mickelson what he thinks about X, Y, and Z? And I really don't really care what Phil Mickelson has to say. I do care what Tiger Woods has to say because he has a very unique perspective as a trailblazer.
It seems to me you can look back at the 20th century and make the argument that some of the really big changes have first come through sports. You mentioned the most famous example, Jackie Robinson.
Martin Luther King, he called Jackie Robinson a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. And it's true. You're talking about 1947, almost a decade before the Montgomery bus boycotts. Jackie Robinson was, as Dr. King put it, walking the lonesome road. And oftentimes, sports does prefigure. I mean, and sometimes in bad ways, too. Like Dr. Harry Edwards, the sports sociologist, he calls black athletes the canary in the mine shaft as well. Because when you have a situation where, like today, for example, the number of black athletes playing professional baseball has dropped precipitously. Even in the NBA, it's dipped as there's been an influx of European talent. And in some ways, that prefigures a real taking out of African Americans when it comes to the general workforce in this country, when it comes to the prison population in this country. I mean, Harry Edwards makes a very convincing case for this, that it's a really interesting way to look at where the country is by looking at the position of black athletes.
Dave Zirin is the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States, 250 years of politics, protest, people, and play. He spoke with Steve Paulson.